Stephen Jay Gould, in his book, Reflections in Natural History, claims that man created God in his own image instead of the other way around. He states the theory of natural selection would never have replaced the doctrine of divine creation if evident, admirable design pervaded all organisms. To make his case, he repeats Darwin's question of why are there marsupials that are found only in Australia and nowhere else. He cites Darwin's book on orchids and that the structures evolved to ensure fertilization by insects are jerry-built, and I'm quoting, of available parts used by ancestors for other purposes. He states that orchids are Rube Goldberg machines, a perfect engineer would certainly have come up with something better. Oh, the arrogance and foolishness of man who denies the existence and work of a creator God. Romans 1 sums up the issue very clearly when it says they are professing themselves to be wise, and yet they become fools. Of course, every organism does not have the same level of structure and design. Microscopic amoeba is complex in its own right, but nothing compared to man. And man, for all his wisdom, for all his countless millions of experiments, has never been able to create life. Not even a primitive one-celled organism, much less an orchid. That ought to bother you if you are an evolutionist this morning. David knew from whence man has come. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works. That my soul knoweth right well. How much David knew about just how wonderfully and marvelously we are made, we cannot know. We are learning all the time more and more facts about the wonders of the human body. How much David knew by divine revelation, we're not told. But he knew enough to know that the human body is nothing short of a divine miracle. This morning I want us to look at our skeletal structure and the bones that make up the human body. No researcher has ever discovered a material as well suited for the human body as bone is. Bone comprises only about one-fifth of our body's weight. Way back in 1867, an engineer showed that the arrangement of bone cells forms the lightest structure made of the least amount of material to support the body's weight. Bone possesses incredible strength, enough to support and protect every cell of your body. Your body, economical and efficient down to the last detail. The bones that are hollowed out using a weight-saving principle that it took mankind millenniums to discover. The vacant center inside these stress-bearing bones houses an efficient red blood cell factory that turns out a trillion new cells each and every day. A trillion cells. From the crown of your head to the sole of your foot, your body consists of 206 bones, each one expertly designed to do the job that it needs to do. There are 26 bones in each foot. The soccer player will subject those bones, each of them, to a cumulative force of well over 1,000 pounds per foot over the course of a single game. The average person will walk over 65,000 miles in their lifetime on these perfectly engineered feet, some 2.5 times around the world. Our body weight is evenly spread out through architecturally perfect arches, which serve as springs, and the bending of our knees and ankles absorbs the stress that our body has put through. Your bones are alive. Bone spends its days changing and flowing and correcting and shifting, like a river, as well as like a rock. When bone is cut, it bleeds. When a bone breaks, it heals itself. Imagine an engineer developing a substance that can grow continuously, lubricate itself, require no shutdown time, and repair itself when damage occurs. This engineer would be regarded as a genius, lauded as a hero, win a Nobel Prize among other honors. Your bones can do all of that, and there are some who deny very existence of their designer and believe it all came about by accident. and your bone breaks, a sophisticated process is initiated by your body. Repair cells invade the area in swarms. Within less than 2 weeks, a cartilage-like sheath called callus surrounds the area of the break, and cement-laying cells, the masons of your body, enter the jellied mass. These cells are called osteoblasts, the pothole fillers of your body, of your bones. They begin to gradually break down the callus, replace it with fresh, new, living bone. 2 or 3 months, the fracture site is marked by a mass of new bone that bulges over the ends of where the break was. Later, any surplus material is scavenged and cleaned away so that the new bone closely resembles the original bone before the fracture occurred. A baby is born with 350 bones, some of which will gradually fuse together so that eventually you'll only have 206 bones, 144 less than the number he started with. Many of a baby's bones are soft and pliable and don't seem to have the necessary characteristics of bone at all. But if it were not so, a baby would be compressible and flexible, and all babies would have to be born by C-section. Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 5 says that, "As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God, who maketh all." God forms them in a special, soft, pliable way to start off life with. It's a good thing, since they will invariably at some point during babyhood roll off the bed or bathroom counter and onto the floor, yet suffer no broken bones. Those of you that are parents, have you had that happen? We haven't either. That's another one of those things, before you have kids, will never happen to your kids. Huh. My kid will never roll off the bathroom counter. I love my children. Okay? Hope they don't. I think 4 out of 5 of ours have. And some of you did when you were little. And some of you may have even hit your head first. But God made them in a way, and you say, "Oh, surely they've broken bones," and you pick them up and they haven't. Our bones are incredible things. Under a scope, with enough magnification, you can observe movement in bones. There are 2 different types of active cells that you can observe: osteoblasts, which we mentioned a moment ago, and osteoclasts. The osteoblasts repair fractures and breaks, but they don't simply wait around for accidents to happen. Billions of them are laboring inside of you at any given moment, replacing overaged bone. When you were young, 100% of the bone in your body is replaced every year. The jawbone you had as a 4-year-old did not contain a single same cell of bone that you had as a 3-year-old. Every bit of it's replaced. Thanks to pre-recorded DNA instructions inherent in each cell, the shape stayed the same, and your jaw was a little larger since you were still growing. As you get up in years, the bone gets replaced much less often. In fact, in 5 years' time, it won't even be completely replaced. Whereas as a young child, every year it's more than completely replaced, over 100%, and it keeps on going. As you get older, in 5 years' time, it won't even be completely replaced. And that is why elderly people have bones that are more brittle, and there's one reason why they break bones fairly often, even though they're no longer climbing trees or playing on monkey bars or bouncing on the bed or jumping off the roof, for the most part. How does the old bone get removed? It must be dynamited out and vacuumed away. The other cells that are active in your quote-unquote rigid bone structure are called osteoclasts, like osteoblasts, except with a C instead of a B. These are the demolition team. Osteoclasts are large, packed with an average of 10 to 30 nuclei in each cell. You had a load-bearing wall made entirely of bricks that you wanted to replace, and you know it had no other way of supporting the roof during the process. The only way possible would be to remove a brick at a time and replace it with a new one, and then replace another brick and replace it with a new one and replace another brick, and so on and so on. And over a process of time, you could replace the entire wall brick by brick, but if you tore the whole wall down at one time, the roof would collapse. But if you do it just a brick at a time, in time, you can replace all the old bricks with new ones. That is kind of how osteoclast and osteoblast work. The clasts remove parts of bone one cell at a time. They tunnel through bone as easily as moles tunnel through a lawn, opening up holes for the blasts to fill. The blasts come along and fill each hole with healthy new bone material. The clast cell has been described as a kamikaze, boring through bone with such reckless abandon that it will not last longer than 48 hours before it burns itself out, and then it too is carried away by the body and discarded as waste. The blasts and the clasts go about their respective jobs in a person's body throughout their lifetime. The first half of a person's life, the blasts are more predominant, laying down new bone in the orderly design of new growth. The demolition clasts eventually outpace the tired blasts. As you get up in age, in old age, the teeth sockets decrease in size and the jaw angles more, and a broken bone takes much longer to repair. The blasts are barely up to their duties of routine maintenance, let alone major repair jobs. As old bone is renewed, the blasts factor into their design necessary adjustments for the stress that that bone will undertake. All bone elements are arranged in perfectly engineered intersecting lines of stress, like the girders on a steel bridge. Your body will make whatever adjustments are necessary for maximum function and use. If you break your foot and the pain of it healing causes you to adjust your walk to where you start taking shorter steps than you took before, then likewise your body makes adjustments to compensate for the compensation you made. The lines of stress in the heel bone will gradually change and end up at a new angle to the bone, to the leg, and the blast will accommodate your situation to make the best of it, the best of a bad situation. If you start weightlifting, your bones become thicker, develop extra struts, if you will, on the stress side. The stress stimulates bone growth. You rest in a hospital bed for a prolonged time, and your bones may lose up to 50% of their calcium because they're not being used. Astronauts in outer space for prolonged periods of time start losing calcium because they no longer have the resistance of gravity against their bodies. And so their bodies start just pulling back and they don't need that calcium. You ever considered all the marvelous functions of the various bones in your body? The tremendous design put into each and every one to allow you to freely do the things that you do day by day without even thinking about it. Your spine is a column of 24 vertebrae set one upon another. Your spine is so designed that it can hold you straight and erect, and yet you can still turn your head or twist your body if you choose. You can bend forward or backward. You can coil and uncoil. You can twist and turn in an instant and still retain your balance. Each vertebrae is rigid and made up of solid bone. But the string of vertebrae, like pearls on a necklace, can assume many shapes. Each vertebrae is separated from the next vertebrae by a cushion, which makes your spine a tremendous shock absorber for your body. Any great impact at the base of the spine is absorbed all along the way by each of those shock absorbers all the way up your spine, each one lessening the impact as it is passed along. By the time each little shock absorber cushion has dealt with it, it has been reduced to almost nothing so that it is hardly even felt and does not even cause problems by the time it reaches the top of the spine. Were it not for this important feature, you would jar your brain with every step you take. When you have a pounding headache, your brain's sensation of pain is intensified. Try jogging with a migraine. That'll give you a small idea of what normal life would be like if your body did not have all those cushions between each vertebrae. Then every step you take would put that much pressure on your brain. Consider any of the bones of your body. The 8 bones of your wrist, the 19 bones of your hand. The hand is the most useful tool in all the world. Consider the vast variety of functions the human hand can perform. Typing, hammering, playing a piano, carrying a heavy load, drawing and painting, fighting, shooting a basketball, firing a gun, communicating in sign language, grasping a rope, wrestling, throwing a football or baseball, and on and on and on. The list is endless. Consider the hands of the mechanic, the surgeon, the athlete, the sculptor, the carpenter, the botanist, the architect, truck driver, the engineer, the chef, the electrician, the artist, the barber, the secretary, and on and on and on. Each one with hands that can function in miraculous ways without us even giving it much conscious thought. And yet our hands will do what we ask them to do. You ever considered all the wondrous things that your hands can do? It was Isaac Newton who said, in the absence of any other proof, the thumb alone would convince me of God's existence. In the absence of any other proof, the thumb alone would convince me of God's existence. Consider how the bones in your body are connected and how they function with each other. Consider your joints. Ordinarily, barring injury or disease, they work remarkably smoothly and free from pain. At the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, England, a team of chemists and engineers compared the frictional properties of the cartilage lining our joints with that of materials that engineers used for bearings. They were seeking a material suitable for use in artificial hips. Initially, they calculated that the friction present in the knee of an ox is about one-fifth that of highly polished metal, about the same friction as ice on ice. Man, for all of his studies and research and experiments, was one-fifth as efficient in reducing friction as the knee that God put in an ox. Researched further and found that joint cartilage is filled with tiny channels full of a synovial fluid. The cartilage is compressible. And as the joint moves, the part of the cartilage bearing the strain compresses, causing jets of this fluid to squirt out. The fluid forms a sort of forced pressure lubrication, which lifts the two surfaces apart. When the joint moves further, a different part of the surface bears the stress. And then fluid in the new area then squirts out, while the area just relieved of pressure expands and sucks its fluid back in. Thus, in active movement, the joint surfaces do not really touch, but float on jets of liquid. The engineers were astonished. The boundary lubrication and pressure lubrication were recent developments in engineering, or so they had thought. I will praise thee, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. A man can spend dozens of years, hundreds of years, millions of dollars in research, and finally come up with something that's one-fifth as efficient what God designed to begin with. You can examine any area of the human body. It's that complex, that precise, that brilliant, that efficient, that incredible. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, that my soul knoweth right well. You know, we miss it. We look in the mirror and we don't like the way God made us look. We don't realize when God created us, He worked a miracle. And what He has given us staggers the imagination. You might rather believe that all of that came about by accident, by luck, by chance. Comfortable and confidently secure and resting the theory of evolution, then I would challenge you to study evolution. Study. Don't just take the word of some teacher in some public school classroom. Study it. Awful lot hangs in the balance. Awful lot hangs in the balance. Have you ever really, really studied what you claim to believe? Evolution would be funny except for two things. Number one, people believe it. Number two, the consequences are tragic. Stephen Jay Gould, in his book that I cited earlier, talking about how all of the different creatures and creations have struggled for survival in this world. He is an evolutionist. And here's what he writes. He says, many organisms follow a different strategy in the struggle for existence. They produce vast numbers of seeds or eggs, hoping, so to speak, that a few will survive the rigors of early life. These organisms are often controlled by their predators, and their evolutionary defense must be a strategy that minimizes the chance of being eaten. Cicadas and bamboo seeds seem to be particularly tasty to a wide variety of organisms. Natural history, to a large extent, is a tale of different adaptations to avoid predation. Some individuals hide. Others taste bad. Others grow spines or spikes or thick shells. Still others evolve to look conspicuously like a noxious relative. The list is nearly endless, a stunning tribute to nature's variety. Bamboo seeds and cicadas follow an uncommon strategy. They are eminently and conspicuously available, but so rarely and in such great numbers that predators cannot possibly consume the entire bounty. Among evolutionary biologists, this defense goes by the name of predator satiation. Now, do you understand what he's saying? Bamboo seeds and cicadas have purposely orchestrated an overwhelming number of offspring or seeds or whatever you want to call it to offset being exterminated by other predators, that they have planned it. Now listen to how he goes into this. An effective strategy of predator satiation involves two adaptations. First, the synchrony of emergence or reproduction must be very precise, thus assuring that the market is truly flooded and only for a short time. Secondly, this flooding cannot occur very often, lest predators simply adjust their own life cycle to predictable times of superfluity. If bamboos flowered every year, seed eaters would track the cycle and present their own abundant young with the annual bounty. But if the period between episodes of flowering far exceeds the lifespan of any predator, then the cycle cannot be tracked, except by one peculiar primate that records its own history. I think that's you and me. The advantage of synchronicity to individual bamboos and cicadas is clear enough. Anyone out of step is quickly gobbled up. Cicada stragglers do occasionally emerge in off years, but they never gain a foothold. The hypothesis of predator satiation, though unproven, meets the primary criterion of a successful explanation. It coordinates a suite of observations that would otherwise remain unconnected and, in this case, downright peculiar. We know, for example, that bamboo seeds are relished by a wide variety of animals, including many vertebrates with long lifespans. The rarity of flowering cycles shorter than 15 or 20 years makes sense in this context. We also know that the synchronous setting of seed can inundate an affected area. Now, stay with me, because this is important, because you wouldn't believe me if I just told you this guy's argument. I want you to listen to it. This is a leading evolutionist of our day. He sums it up. The synchrony of three species among cicadas is particularly impressive, especially since years of emergence vary from place to place, while all three species invariably emerge together in any one area. But I am most impressed by the timing of the cycles themselves. Why do we have 13 and 17 year cicadas, but no cycles of 12, 14, 15, 16, or 18? 13 and 17 share a common property. They are large enough to exceed the life cycle of any predator, but they are also prime numbers, divisible by no integer smaller than themselves. Many potential predators have 2 to 5 year life cycles. Such cycles are not set by the availability of periodical cicadas, for they peak too often in years of non-emergence. But cicadas might be eagerly harvested when the cycles coincide. Consider a predator with a cycle of 5 years. If cicadas emerged every 15 years, each bloom would be hit by the predator. But cycling at a large prime number, cicadas minimize the number of coincidences. Every 5 times 17, or 85 years in this case. 13 and 17 year cycles cannot be tracked by any smaller number. Existence is, as Darwin stated, a struggle for most creatures. The weapons of survival need not be claws and teeth. Patterns of reproduction may serve as well. Occasional superfluity is one pathway to success. It is sometimes advantageous to put all your eggs in one basket, but be sure to make enough of them, and don't do it too often. Now, do you understand that? See, the reason cicadas come out... I'm sorry, I thought you would. The reason cicadas come out every 13 and 17 years is so none of their predators can track the cycle and coincide their cycle of offspring to be able to gobble them up every time they come out. Now, can you imagine a cicada sitting down in the ground thinking that one more year? One more year and it's safe to come up. Can you imagine that? And yet that's what the evolutionist wants you to believe. That's how he accounts for that. Predator satiation. I want to tell you that takes a lot more faith to believe than the Bible. If you believe in evolution, you need to know what you believe. Here's an article by Richard Leakey. Richard, help, my brain is leaky. Habitually walking around on the hind limbs, Leaving the forelimbs free for other jobs is an unusual mode of locomotion. That's what you guys do. That's an unusual mode of locomotion, so you'll know. Once our ancestors had adopted an upright stance, many things associated with being human became possible, such as fine manipulation with the hands and the carrying of food back to a base camp. I do not mean to suggest that around 4 million years ago, primitive hominids evolved walking upright in order to use their hands in refined ways or develop a food-sharing economy. Indeed, this cannot be the case because this behavior did not arise until several million years after the development of upright walking. You know, we're really not too bright. For several million years, we walked around and didn't even use our hands. They just hung there. And these things get in the way. I wish I didn't have these. And one day, some Neanderthal man picked up something. And whoa, that's incredible. And somebody else did it. And we've gone from doing that to making tools and making fire. And people sit there and think, wow, that's neat. No, it's stupid. That's not neat at all. For several million years, we walked around and didn't even use our hands or arms. And you think that's intelligent? Some doctor with a PhD that's been in some university so long that his brain has turned to mush, and we say, wow, that guy's brilliant. No, he's not brilliant. Why is it we think that's the thing to believe in, and that's the intellectual road to knowledge? It's not at all. You have to be a fool. The fool has said in his heart there is no God. Darwin himself saw a truly exquisite design as a problem for his theory of evolution. He wrote this: to suppose that the eye, with all its innumerable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I confess, absurd in the highest degree. I agree. Amen. That is absurd in the highest degree. But then, covering his bases, he goes on to say this: reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a simple and imperfect eye to one complex and perfect can be shown to exist, each grade being useful to its possessor, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, should not be considered as subversive of the theory. In answer to the question, what good is 5% of an eye? For instance, if you're going to believe that the eye evolved, at one point a creature had no eye. So if it starts evolving an eye, the questioner is asked, what good is 5% of an eye? Now, the correct answer to that is nothing. There is no good to 5% of an eye. But here's how they answer that. We must argue that the possessor of such an incipient structure did not use it for sight. How in the world did it continue to evolve and develop as an eye then? But that is how they get around. What good is 5% of an eye? Oh, well, when they were evolving that, they weren't using it for an eye. Well, pray tell, what were they using it for? We think that somehow, oh, 5% didn't use it, 10% didn't use it, 20%, 30%. One day they woke up, they got to 50%, they think, hey, I think I can make this thing function. I'm tired of running into things. I think I'll use it for an eye today. And we sit around and think, man, these guys are brilliant. Years of research went into this. Same man that wrote that. By the way, one of the leading evolutionists of our time, the same man that wrote that, went on to write this: common sense is a very poor guide to scientific insight. I guess so. Based on that, Stephen Jay Gould is a scientific genius. And by the way, he is regarded as such by his colleagues. In his book, Ever Since Darwin, Reflections in Natural History, on the back of that book, here is what his contemporary evolutionists have to say about him. Ever since Darwin is a remarkable achievement by any measure, Gould is profoundly intelligent, a writer of great natural wit. I found it funny. And his sophistication and learning range far beyond the parameters of his academic field, biology. It was by David Walston, editor of the Field Museum of Natural History Bulletin. P.B. Medawar of the Sciences calls Gould a shrewd and learned intellectual. Carl Sagan says Darwinian essays, referring to this book, which combine literacy, comprehensibility, and depth of insight. These appealing essays deserve a wide audience. That's why I read some of them to you this morning. Ashley Montague, The Stephen Jay Gould is one of the most brilliant of our younger biologists, gifted, among other things, with the ability to write. These essays on a fascinating variety of topics in natural history are original, informative, enlightening, and stimulating. The fortunate reader will relish them. Why would you purposely reject the Bible and accept that? Only because you want to. Only because you want to. But I want to tell you that denying the truth does not change the consequences. And you can choose to say, well, I'm staking my life with this. But if you're wrong, you're not innocent. You're not blameless. God will hold you accountable for the truth of this book, whether you choose to believe it or not. And you can walk away and reject it and think that thereby you are exempt from any punishment at the hand of God. But Malachi tells us, God says, I will not at all acquit the wicked. And when you stand in judgment day before God and say, well, God, I didn't know. See, I believed in evolution. God doesn't know. Okay, you're pardoned. See, I will not at all acquit the wicked. There is a God who made you. You did not evolve. He loved you enough to die for you. And he wants to save you.